Welcome to the Bookshelf. Tonight we conclude the two-part series from Pivot Spokane and their presentation of February 8th called Love Hurts. A little later tonight, Sam Joseph and Harry Neff, but right now, Paige Powers.
So I'm at work, and I work in the bottom right-hand corner of a basement. There's no walls to the outside or windows to the outside, and it can already feel kind of constricting. So I'm sitting there, and something happens, and I honestly don't even remember what it was, but something happened, and it reminded me of him. And in that moment, all I wanted to do was pick up my phone and text him, or call him and hear his voice, or just have some type of connection with him. And as I'm sitting there and I'm realizing that I can't, and that feeling is sinking in, I can literally start to feel the walls closing in around me. And I started to shake, kind of like I am now. And my breath literally started to shorten, and I had to focus on breathing. So I started walking to the stairs, and by the time I got to the top of them, I was practically running. And I burst into our bathroom, thank God no one else was in there. And I locked myself in a stall, and for about 20 minutes, I just sat on the toilet and silently held my head in my hands, and I just cried. So 6 months before that, I'm at Chap's Bakery with Colin. It's a Saturday morning, and we're just kind of trying to figure out what we want to do with the day. And on a whim, we decide to go camping. His uncle had told us about this kind of fun spot up by the Montana-Idaho border, and so we decided, why not? Quickly paid our bill, rushed back to his house, packed up anything we thought was relevant, and got on the road. So we drove out to the border. It's this place called Blossom Lake. And when you get there, you have to hike in 3 miles, super steep, totally exhausted by the time you get to the top. But when you get there, obviously it's 100% worth it. It's just like one of those little gems that's just hidden inside of a mountain. Beautiful lake, wilderness all around. Have a picture on my phone if anyone wants to see after. So we walked around the lake for a while. And we found a spot where we wanted to pitch our tent, and so we did. And by this time, it's dinner time. And when we packed, we hadn't really thought about food. So all we had brought was some leftover Pizza Pipeline pizza from the night before. And so we made a fire, and we tried to, like, warm it over the fire, and it did not work. So we pretty much both had one slice of cold pizza for dinner. But I didn't even care, because I was just having so much fun with him. We walked down to the lake as the sun was setting. Of course, it was beautiful, and then the moon came out, and the way it was hitting the water was just glistening, and it was perfect. And then we walked back up to the tent, and we laid in our sleeping bags, and we played that game where one person says a sentence, and the other person says a sentence, and you go back and forth, and you make a dumb story. And we played that for, like, hours and just laughed, and I have never laughed as hard as I did that night with someone. As I'm laying there in my sleeping bag, I remember just looking over at him and just thinking to myself, I am so incredibly happy, and I am so in love. So a few months later, we go to Seattle for New Year's Eve. All of our friends live over there, so we decided to celebrate the holiday with them. And it was a really fun night. All my girlfriends and I got ready at my friend Anya's house, and all the guys got ready, or whatever guys do, at their house. And so we'd all done our makeup and our hair all beautiful, and I was wearing this kind of tight, sparkly dress. I kind of looked like a disco ball. And so we met up with all the guys at this place called The Attic. Our friend Connor had rented out the place. And I don't exactly remember what Colin was wearing, but I just remember thinking he looked so handsome that night. So we hang out there for a while, and then we decide to go to Q Nightclub on Capitol Hill. And when we get there, we have to wait in line for like an hour, even though we'd already bought tickets, so I was kind of annoyed. And by the time we're walking in, it's literally like 11:50 p.m. We get in, I really want to check my coat, so we go over to the coat check. That takes a few minutes. So the point is, by the time the guy is handing me my ticket, saying, you know, you're good to go, the countdown is starting. Everyone's yelling, 10, 9, 8. So Colin and I start booking it over to the dance floor where all of our friends are, because we want to be with them at midnight. And as we're like swerving through people, in this crowded club, I'm hearing 6, 5, 4. And in my head, I'm like, there's no way we're going to make it over there. And he must have thought the same thing, because at that moment, he stopped and he just turned towards me. And he took my head in his hands. And we made this intense eye contact. And he said, "Paige, I am so glad I am here with you tonight." And in the background, I can hear everyone yelling, 3, 2, 1, Happy New Year. In my peripherals, I can see and I can feel the confetti falling down, and I can hear the New Year song starting to play. But in that moment, all I was focused on was him. In that moment, it was just me and him. And he leaned in to kiss me, and I thought to myself, I am so incredibly happy right now, and I am so in love. So now I'm in my car. I had just gotten off work, and it's a Friday. And Fridays are my favorite day of the week, because on Fridays, Colin gets off at noon. So when I get off at 4:35, I drive straight to his house. He has a cute little house up on the South Hill. And when I get there, we hang out for like an hour or two and just cuddle on the couch and kind of decompress from the week. And then eventually we start making plans for that night and the weekend. But for those couple hours, it's just me and him just being together. So I'm in my car, engine running, and I'm sitting there and I'm feeling confused and defeated, and I just don't know what to do, because I can't go over to his house this Friday, and that's because we'd broken up the night before. And as I'm sitting there and it's sinking in, and I'm realizing I can't get what I want, because all I desperately want is to be able to walk in his front door, have him look up from the Xbox game he would undoubtedly be playing, and motion for me to come over so I could just fall into his arms and feel home at the end of a long week. And I'm sitting there in my car, and I realize I can't do that. And I don't really know what happened, but all of a sudden I'm driving. And I'm driving up the South Hill, up Grand, left on 37th. And all of a sudden I'm in front of his house. And I didn't see him, but his car was in the driveway and his living room light was on. And that was enough to send me over. I immediately started bawling. And I was able to maneuver my car around the corner, but as soon as I was out of sight, I just stopped and I turned my engine off, and in the silence of my car, I just sat there and I uncontrollably sobbed for like half an hour probably. And I was just thinking to myself, I'm so unhappy and I feel so alone. And that was almost a year ago today, actually. That was February 3rd of last year. And I wish I had more time so I could truly explain to you guys how miserable I was for those couple months. I have never cried so much. I have never felt so depressed. I've never been so unhappy. And side note, I'm a strong feminist woman, and so it really pisses me off that the hardest thing I've ever gone through is a breakup over some silly boy. But here I am. And they do say that time heals everything, and in my experience, I have found that to be true. My friend Emily, her birthday is May 20th, and so this past year for her birthday, we went up to Whidbey Island to celebrate. Her family has a cabin up there. It was a great weekend, friends, laughter, it was perfect. And on that last Sunday, we were driving back. It was me, my best friend Natalie, and my really great friend Julia. And it was a Sunday, we didn't really have to be home at any particular time, so we were just taking our time, and we decided to stop at the Horses by the Columbia River. And so we pull off the side of the road, walk up the trail. It's a super short but super steep trail, and when you get to the top, it's a total letdown because the horses are covered in graffiti. They're totally trashed, but the view is perfect. Let me try and describe it for you. So, first of all, it's about 4 p.m., so it's the golden hour, so the sun is just hitting everything perfectly. Got the Columbia River in front of you, And the way the sun is hitting it, the water is literally just sparkling. And then you have rolling hills, of course, sun perfectly hitting it. And it's May, so it's still that time of the year where when you feel the sun on your skin, it still feels so just refreshing after a long winter. So we're walking around, and I specifically remember I stood on top of a rock. I'm looking out at this view. I look to my left, and I look to my right, and I'm standing next to these amazing, inspiring women who, over the past few months, have truly taught me the value of friendship. And I start to feel something. And it takes me a second, and then I realize what I'm feeling is just pure happiness. And I realize I have not felt that in months. So I'm standing on the rock, looking at this beautiful view with these beautiful women. And I think to myself, I am so happy, and I feel so loved.
Paige Powers in the first of three Pivot stories heard tonight on The Bookshelf.
Sam Joseph, everyone.
Thank you. My wife and I have three lovely daughters who all now live in New York City, but they've had some incredible experiences in their adult lives, living in some fantastic and some far-flung places. Their escapades, I have to tell you, though, have struck fear in my heart on many occasions, fear of, for their safety. What when one was commuting on her little motor scooter on a daily basis on these shaky side roads in Chiang Mai, Thailand, visions that she would end up in a third world hospital with her flip-flops torn off and her legs in tatters. Another daughter living in a dingy neighborhood in Dakar, Senegal. My fears that she'd be abducted by Boko Haram or whomever. And a third who went off, moved on her own without a job or money or any contacts to a jungle, New York City. Who of you parents hasn't had that fear of danger to your child? And what would we do in the instance that that danger befell one of our kids? As the saying goes, a parent should never have to witness the death of their child. That in literary terms is foreshadowing, I think, right? Even a doc knows that. But let's go back, 1950, June, southwestern Pennsylvania. A beautiful little baby was born, her name was Nancy. Mom had already suffered one miscarriage, but this child was seemingly perfect. I remember even as a child, a couple years younger than she, that she really embodied the beauty and joviality of a love that even a little kid, not in those terms, could relate to. As she grew up, her beauty was even greater, and I remember her friends likening her beauty to that of Natalie Wood or Mary Tyler Moore. Then a couple years later, another kid came along, a little less perfect perhaps, but a keeper nonetheless. That was me. We had a pretty great childhood, a typical middle-class upbringing in a dingy, aging coal mine and steel mill town in southwestern Pennsylvania. Then, when I was eight, Mom had another baby, Jonathan. Jonathan unfortunately lived for 3 days and suffered what we now call SIDS, or sudden infant death syndrome. Mom sat for hours in the basement crying, and I wondered what I could do to console her. Dad was not very good at this. And all I could do was stare at her bloodshot eyes and hug her and try to comfort her in her inability to express her pain of loss. At that point then, if you're keeping track, the family building score is 2-4. Not a bad score if you're a baseball team, but really pretty lousy if you're trying to build a family. Nevertheless, Nancy and I had a wonderful childhood growing up, somewhat indulged upon by our loving family, although at this point they were a paternalistic family, a father who was a first generation Middle Eastern American. But that's another story. All was well until Nancy began showing signs of deep ennui. staying in bed, not wanting to interact, a real deep depression. This was such contrast to the jovial, effervescent young girl that she had always been, that I knew of at least. This was a very difficult thing for me to deal with, being the emotionally stunted, nerdy little brother. All I wanted to do is go out and play wiffle ball and capture the flag and tell fart jokes. And all Nancy wanted to do was stay in her room and sleep and weep. Remember, this was the 1960s, and there was very little that we knew and acknowledged about things emotional and psychiatric. Eventually and inexplicably, when she was 14, she took a handful of drugs in an effort to kill herself. After a short hospitalization, she recovered fully and returned home to presumably lead a normal life. But unfortunately, this was punctuated by increasingly frequent bouts of depression and deeper bouts of depression. Again, it's a strange thing for a family to deal with when mental illness was thought of at that time to be a personal failure or a family flaw, not the disease that we now recognize it to be. Then when she was 18 and I was 16, my parents surprised us and surely themselves with another child. His name was Jeff. Jeff was a great little guy, although he was growing up now under an aging parents and an increasingly grumpy and demanding father. By then, I was off to a private school in Pittsburgh, about an hour and a half away, 5 days a week. And Nancy was enrolled in a college, so our interactions with Jeff were infrequent, just weekends and holidays and summers. I can remember being more like a father figure than a big brother. After all, he was my 16-year younger mini-me, and I had great aspirations for him and hopes that he would be all the things that I indeed had hoped to be as well. Then during the fall of my senior year in high school, I got the horrible phone call. When a faculty member came to my dorm room telling me there was an important phone call from home, where did my thoughts go but to my worst nightmares? Was it mom or dad? Was it Jeff? Nancy was certainly on the list highest at risk. I took the phone call, remember, being more stunned than surprised. Nancy had disappeared. I had to get home quickly, as something surely had dire happened. I remember during the ride home, my teacher tried to reassure me and divert my attention, and I tried to interact with him as a polite kid, but all my thoughts could do was go to the vision of Nancy's pain and the pain that mom and dad were surely suffering now that they wondered what happened to their daughter. The dreary ride home through the gray, dark countryside of the Pennsylvania Turnpike and the country roads leading to our home conjured images of the darkness that must have pervaded Nancy through those dark hours. When I got home, my frenetic parents had realized that their daughter, who was only about 5'1" and literally had never held a weapon in her hand before, went to a local sporting goods store, bought a rifle, drove herself to the woods, and took her life. Devastation. What would make this sort of fate befall this beautiful young lady? Love, it really hurts. At this point, family score was 2-5. After many months of ache and pain, things seemed to get back to normal a bit, or did they? You know, parents whose relationship had dwindled, they became further and further apart. It could be said that when a couple has no love, there could be no hurt. But in fact, they were miserable. We were miserable watching them, and it hurt Jeff and me to see their relationship dwindle further. Their world had turned upside down, certainly. But rather than have that episode bring them together, they drifted further apart and focused their attentions more on Jeff and me. The situation wasn't like a million other kids in the United States or throughout the world, but this situation was already burdened by a deep loss of our family. Years later, Jeff had been going to a parochial school in an effort to get away from the racial and educational strife that was so rampant in so many cities in that time. He seemed to adjust pretty well to it, and he was taken under the wing of an attentive priest, Father Joe. a little too attentive, I thought. Jeff never spoke ill of this man, but there were telltale signs that there were things beyond the usual teacher-student relationship. We'll never know if Jeff was abused. As a winter night in the 16th year of his life, he was seen by a passing motorist to throw himself off the high-rise Lane Bain Bridge. Love, it really hurts. Now mom and dad were 1 for 5, a lousy score no matter how you're calculating this. So I tell this story not because of for sympathy or self-pity or other self-serving reasons, but other than for a few of my friends, no one knows of this past, of my pain and lost love. But rather, I tell the story for the philosophic lessons that it taught me of how the depth of love, parental love, sibling love, and the loss of that love, and the resilience of the human spirit, and how we're able to carry on despite these losses. These losses have shown me, given me a template of how I would deal with future losses, personal losses, family losses, professional losses. As a critical care doc, I dealt with this kind of grief and turmoil almost on a daily basis. It also showed me the wonder and love and beauty and vitality of the lives we now live. So now when Jane and I walk down a busy New York sidewalk, our three girls walking in front of us, arm in arm, clearly showing the love and compassion they have for one another, I know that our family, at least for the time being, has gone 3 for 3. Thank you.
Sam Joseph. Now concluding Pivot with another kind of doctor, Harry Neff.
Several months ago, I had a dream, and in the dream, I got in front of a group of people, and I put on an ornate raven headdress, and from within the confines of this mask, I uttered the words, "I am so anxious all the time," and I sat down. Valentine's Day, 1982, my dad died. I barely knew my dad. He and my mom divorced shortly after I was born. He suffered with bipolar disorder, which had become increasingly bad over the 14 years of their marriage and the 8 kids that they had. He would call the house every now and then, and after a few moments of talking with him, I'd pass the phone off to one of my 7 older siblings. It was uncomfortable hearing his voice straining to make connection. He sounded nice, but kind of like I needed to be worried about him. I remember several of these calls, until the final one, the altar call. It was as if a tsunami was being set off in the middle of the ocean as the phone rang. And then my stepdad's voice changed, and the wave grew bigger, calling my mom over to the phone and saying, "It's about Bob." It grew bigger, and then my mom burst out in tears. It arrived on shore as we sat down in the living room, and she said, "Your dad killed himself in Phoenix, Arizona, jumping off of a building." Not much happened after that. There was no memorial. I went to school alone the next day in a fog. His death was mentioned occasionally, but I thought about it all the time. As a psychotherapist, I have the honor of being with others as they seek to untangle the places where love has hurt. And as the Sufi mystic poet Rumi says, the cure for pain is in the pain. It is with these words that I found myself in January of 2010 heading to Phoenix, Arizona to the Hyatt Regency. Getting out of the car, there was an eerie, almost familiar feeling as if I had been there before. Come to find out that I was within a phone ringing distance of where my dad's body felt its last pain. Standing on the sidewalk with my backpack on, not really sure of what I was going to do, I thought, I'll walk around the building. That made sense somehow. Looking up at the building as I walked down the street, I wondered where he jumped from. I wondered how many people have jumped off this building to kill themselves. If I'd had a smartphone at the time, I would have sat alone on a park bench and Googled and tried to find the answers, but I didn't, so I looked around. At the end of the block, there was someone with a vest on, and it said, "Ask me." You've probably seen these in cities. They hire ambassadors to be available to answer questions. And so I asked. Yeah, I've got kind of a different question. Do you know how many people have killed themselves jumping off of this building? The man sputtered something about not knowing anything about that, and me not really knowing what else to ask, he shuffled off looking for someone with a more innocuous question, like, "Can you tell me where I can find a good margarita?" Which was sounding better all the time. Discouraged, I continued my pilgrimage down the street. Halfway down the block, I saw another person with this vest on ask me. Everything inside me said, "Stop being so weird." As I pushed myself towards him, and I asked. The man was around 65 years old and pretty warm, friendly. And he said he knew of a couple suicides happening, but he really wasn't sure how many. Before I knew what I was going to ask next, the words came out of my mouth. "Do you know anything about the suicide that happened on Valentine's Day of 1982? It was my dad, you see, and I'm just curious about what happened, like where he jumped from, I guess." His eyes got big, and he said, "I was there. That was your dad?" A warm wave of energy flowed into me, a reverse tsunami, a reconstituting, amazing coherence. As he continued to say, he worked at the men's clothing store just down from where my dad's mental illness was cemented. He talked about how proud he was of the city that day. The people from the restaurant came out with tablecloths and they covered his body, and he was very intent on telling me that it was a very sacred moment. The city handled that so well. The past had caught up with me. Checking into the hotel, I asked them, "Is there anyone that's working tonight that may have worked in 1982? Doubtfully, they looked at me, but after conferring, they said, actually, they thought Jerry up in the restaurant, she may have worked there in 1982, and she was working that night. I went and checked into my room and went up to the restaurant that turns like the Space Needle up at the top of the hotel and sat sipping a beer and writing in my journal, watching the winter sunset over Phoenix. And after a little while, Jerry came by. And after confirming that she worked there in 1982, I invited her to sit down, and I asked the question, "Do you happen to know anything about the suicide that occurred on Valentine's Day of 1982? It was my dad, you see, and I'm just curious about what happened." She gasped. She was shaken. "I was there that day. I knew your dad. He would come into the restaurant from time to time. He'd bring gifts of jewelry to the waitresses, probably after he was released from the hospital, after stabilizing long enough on medications with a little money in his pocket. She knew him as Preacher Bob, and he would speak to her of God's love. She explained that she was an alcoholic at the time and being very self-destructive in her own way. And it was later that she became sober and became born again." Born again. Such a lovely, lovely phrase. Love hurts, but love also heals. My brother Alec, who's closest to me in age, the smartest of the Neffs, He could master anything athletically, it seemed to me, intellectually, musically, and made it look easy. He suffers with mental illness, and many of you have probably seen him on the street singing songs. Perhaps you've heard his spoon song that brought world peace. The cure for pain is in the pain. I'm so anxious all the time. Thank you.
That was Harry Neff. Earlier tonight, we heard from Paige Powers and Sam Joseph. Pivot Spokane is a recently formed organization, and biographical information about these storytellers, their past stories, and their future events can all be found at their website of pivotspokane.com. Tonight and last night's stories can be heard at our website, spokanepublicradio.org or kpbx.org. For the book shelf, I'm Vern Windham.